Thank you. Thanks very much, Rick, for inviting me and organizing this event, and thank you, everyone, for coming and listening to my talk. I wrote this book really for two reasons. The first is, and the starting reason, the original reason, was just because I thought Burma has an incredibly rich and colorful history, an interesting history, connecting into many parts of Asia. If you look at the map and look where Burma is, you see very clearly that Burma is very much at the crossroads of Asia. And when you read Burmese history, you realize that Burmese history also connects everywhere, to China, to Tibet, onwards even to Inner Asia, to India, to the Islamic world. And it's been influenced very much by the Indian Ocean, by Thailand, by Cambodia, and all these other countries as well. So I wanted to introduce people to a Burmese history that I think is generally very little known in the West and in this country. But I also wrote the book because I think that, you know, over the last 15 years, ever since the uprising, the pro-democracy uprising in 1988, there's been a lot of interest in Burma and concern about the situation in Burma, but that this concern has kind of evolved outside of any kind of historical context and understanding of Burmese history. And I think part of my book is trying, as an attempt to sort of tell Burmese history in a way which might help to illuminate some of the problems today and make us, if not think afresh, then think in a slightly more historically informed way on the situation today. And I think that sort of effort to try to think about the histories of the countries in which we are trying to help or intervene is extremely important, or we do or we not do it at our own risk, in not just in Burma, but in many other countries as well. I think all of us will agree, and all of us know here today, that there are problems in Burma. As you all know, in 1988, there were massive pro-democracy and anti-government demonstrations in Rangoon and many other cities in towns in the country, which were violently crushed after several weeks by the Burmese military. In 1990, most of you probably know that the government held reasonably free and fair elections, which was won by the National League for Democracy, and that these results were never respected by the military government, which to this day refuses in any meaningful way to begin a transition of political power. We also hear about ongoing human rights abuses, the complete lack of political freedom in the country, the fact that in the southeast of the country, in the Thai border, there continues to be a fairly bloody anti-insurgency campaign. And we also know that, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years, people have tried through sanctions, through boycotts, through different attempts mainly from Western countries to pressure the government, to look for ways to push the government towards a more compromising position. At the same time, there have been complications because a number of other governments, especially in the region, have wanted instead to try to engage the government at least at some level, and there's been increased trade and investment from countries in the region into Burma over the last 10 years. So we're stuck with this question because, in general, we haven't seen any positive progress in terms of democratic change since 1988. And so the question, the policy question is, you know, are sanctions and boycotts and the kinds of policies that have been in place in the United States and the Western countries the right ones, or are they sufficient? In what direction do we go now, when it's very clear, at the very least, that in 2007, things are not necessarily moving in the right direction? But before I get to that, and that's sort of how I would like to conclude in trying to answer some of those questions, I think it's important, again, to go back a little bit and talk about Burma's history and the ways in which perhaps that can help us understand better the choices we actually have and don't have in the country. I'd like to go through maybe five sort of lessons from Burmese history that I think are important to remember or to think about when thinking about the present. The first is what you might call the sort of history of failed state building in Burma. And this is a very long history of failed state building in Burma for very, very different reasons. What's almost unknown in the outside world is that in the 1850s and 1860s, the Burmese government at the time in Mandalay, who were hemmed in by increasing British imperial influence in all directions and pressure from the British Empire, tried unsuccessfully to modernize the country through changes in the tax system, administrative structures, sending students to Europe, embassies to Europe, importing new technologies, and all these things. Very much like what the Thai government or the Siamese government at the time was trying to do, the Japanese government would soon be trying to do. Burma was, if not ahead of the curve, then certainly not behind the curve in these sort of few Asian countries that were still independent at the time, trying to modernize. But that failed, and it failed because, for a number of different reasons, but in the end it failed because in 1885, the British government decided to invade the country for a whole host of reasons, which I can go to if you're interested in question time. And when they did invade the country in 1885, they thought initially it would be an easy war. And it was originally an easy war. It was a two-week war. But then after a couple of weeks or after a few weeks, they were suddenly faced with this massive insurgency, which they didn't understand in the country. And this insurgency, they were wondering what it was all about. They didn't know if it was remnants of the old regime. They didn't know if it was bandits, religious figures, new nationalist forces. But within 2 or 3 years, they had to pour in 4 times as many troops as they had originally going into the country in a very, very bloody suppression of the insurgency at the time, which involved not just a massive surge in the troop presence at the time, but summary executions, the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of people, and in the end, a man-made famine, which finally broke the back of the Burmese insurgency movements and guerrilla campaigns against the British by 1890. But the point about state building is when the dust had settled, almost nothing of the old Burmese traditional structure, which had held parts of the country in place for 1,000 years, the traditional structures of Burmese government, the aristocracy, the monarchy, the court culture, a whole system of scholarship and learning, Buddhist and secular, basically collapsed in the violence of this imposition of British imperial rule in the late 1880s. But then, unlike many other countries in British India, the colonial institutions, which were then imported almost entirely anew from the outside, basically from British India, lasted only another 50 years, which is barely the lifetime, and not the lifetime of a person. And so by 1940, say, in the eve of World War II, or let's say by World War II, you had both the disappearance of traditional institutions, social and political institutions at the center and even at the local level, but you had colonial institutions which were only 50 years old and not rooted at all in local society. They didn't grow out of any sort of compromise with local classes, but instead were imported in this as part of this military occupation process from British India. So then in 1941 and 1942, the Japanese invaded. Burma was physically destroyed because of the Second World War. Many cities and towns in the country were completely obliterated. Rangoon itself was in shambles by 1945. Every single train track, railway, factory, oil field, dockyard was completely blown apart in World War II. But in 1945, when the British reappeared on the scene, what they found was a Burma very different from the one that they had retreated from when the Japanese invaded in 1941. What they faced in 1945 was a Burma that was not only awash with guns, but a Burma that was being organized very dynamically by a group of young radical nationalists led by Aung San, who's the father of Aung San Suu Kyi, the opposition leader, who had originally been collaborators with the Japanese, but then 4 years later had secretly gotten in touch with the Allies, and then had turned against the Japanese and became a partisan force operating behind Japanese lines in the final years of the war. And Lord Louis Mountbatten, against the advice of many army personnel, decided to arm these partisans. And so when the British reappeared on the scene, they had a huge guerrilla force loyal to Aung San, who was then 28 or 29 years old, and still kind of rearing for a fight and demanding that they be recognized as a provisional government of Burma and not wanting to compromise on any kind of long transition to independence. So the colonial order, basically, to make a long story short, by 1948, when the British left, almost disappeared. And the colonial institutions that they left behind, the parliament, the judiciary, the civil service, compared to India, compared to even Pakistan, compared to Ceylon, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Singapore, certainly, were, I think, extremely brittle and may not have lasted very long. But then they didn't last long at all because the other thing the British left behind when they withdrew in 1948 was a civil war. And that's the civil war that carries on to this day. When the British left in 1948, Aung San was dead already. He had held together this nationalist coalition, and in still very mysterious circumstances, him and his entire cabinet was assassinated in July of 1947, 6 months before independence. So in a way, you could say Burma was one of the first governments after World War II to be sort of felled by terrorism. It was an incredible terrorist act when men came in and stormed the cabinet room and essentially machine-gunned down almost everyone there, including Aung San. But that meant that the coalition that he had put together fell apart. And you had the democratic government, the government that the British left behind that was in power in Rangoon, but then you had within a few weeks, a couple of months of independence, an enormous communist insurgency. You had a very popular communist party as well, which suddenly went into rebellion. And then you had the Burmese army at the time, which was split into two parts. There was the old British-trained, mostly ethnic minority-recruited Burma army. And then you had several battalions of Japanese-trained ethnic Burmese nationalist fighters. And they had been merged in an agreement between Aung San and Mountbatten into a single army. Now, when Aung San died and when independence happened and the communists went into insurgency, the ethnic minority battalions within 6 months to 12 months also sort of peeled away from the main army. So you had half of the Burma army, and probably the best trained half, also in revolt. And then you had this huge paramilitary organization which had been loyal to Aung San also go into revolt. So by 1949, the Burmese army controlled only Rangoon and some of the suburbs up to the airport. And they faced, you know, Burma's about the size of France and Britain combined, and the whole rest of the country was essentially in the hands of different insurgent groups. And the Burma army was down to two full battalions, mostly the 4th Burma Rifles that were loyal to a young army officer at the time, General Ne Win. And almost everywhere else in the country was under ethnic minority rebel hands or in communist hands. And I say this because, you know, from the point of view of the Burmese army, in many ways the history of the last 60 years is a history of their pushback of the insurgency from that position. From when they were down to 2,000 men and some military police and paramilitaries and Rangoon, and to this position now when they feel they are on the verge of breaking the back and winning of the insurgency and winning a 60-year civil war. So the first is this whole failed history of state building in the country. And if you look at the armed conflict itself, you know, the civil war went on. The army pushed back the insurgency gradually with many ups and downs. In the early 1950s, the Americans supported the remnants of the Chinese Kuomintang who had entered the country from Yunnan. In the late 1960s, the Chinese communists during the Cultural Revolution had supported a huge surge in the Burmese communist armed insurgency along the Burmese Chinese border. So there are many ups and downs. But in general, the longer history is of a gradual win by the Burmese army against many of these forces. But what happened during that process? What happened during that process was the army became bigger and bigger as it won. And the Burmese decided by the early 1950s they had to create a big army machine in order not just to fight the insurgencies, but to prevent foreign interference, whether it was from the Americans or the Thais or the Chinese or whoever else. And so they went shopping for arms. They started building up this big machine. General Ne Win was very much on top of it. And in 1962, when he staged his coup d'etat, he was able to do this almost without opposition because the army had become, in this context of failed state building and with the fragile structures that the colonial state had left behind, the army was by far the most professional, effective, dominant institution in the country. And as they pushed back the insurgencies, they had taken on more and more administrative tasks at the local level. So the state in Burma in the 50s and 60s was being built as part of this counterinsurgency effort. The third sort of lesson or thing from Burmese history to think about is very much related to the armed conflict, which is the history of ethnicity in Burma and Burmese nationalism. Which over in the 19th century and under the colonial period had developed into a particularly sort of ethnically centered, sour, defensive, borderline sort of xenophobic nationalism. Because Burma had been a very proud and expansive kingdom in the 18th, early 19th century, and nationalism developed as part of this slow collapse of Burmese power in the face of British expansion and aggression. And in the colonial period, there was one perceived slight and humiliation after another. The incorporation of Burma as simply a province of India, the huge influx, uncontrolled influx of hundreds of thousands, millions actually, of people from India into the country. And all these things, and I can go into it more, all these things created a particularly defensive kind of Burmese nationalism, but an ethnically centered one, which didn't include the one-third of the country who were minority peoples. And the British, it's not really a divide-and-rule strategy, but in effect it became like that, ruled the highlands of Burma separately from the lowlands in which most of the Burmese people lived. And even though in the late 1940s the British said we want to manage transition so that the different minority groups can be incorporated as they want into the new country, in effect the British quit the country so completely that they just left the whole sort of ethnic problem kind of on a boil, and it boiled over very quickly. And so you have this huge ethnic problem in the country. It's a country where two-thirds of the population is ethnic Burmese, but a third are split into dozens and dozens of different ethnic minorities in one of the most ethnically and linguistically diverse places in the world. And it's no surprise that, you know, the most ethnically, linguistically diverse places in Burma are up in the mountains, in these little tiny mountain valleys, and that's where the insurgency has been the most robust and most continuous over the last 30 or 40 years. Fourth, and very related to all this, is this sort of myth, I think, that permeates a lot of the Burma discussions of a sort of rich country that somehow went wrong, that there was a prosperous Burma somewhere just, you know, a few decades ago, and it's the military dictatorship alone that somehow benighted the country. It's true that the military's policies have been disastrous since it took over in 62 on many fronts, but I think we have to understand that the problems are even deeper in many ways, and at independence, Burma was actually particularly hobbled by its colonial legacy much more than other British Asian possessions. And lastly, and in a way, I mean, not most importantly, but lastly, are the actual policies that the military took when they took over in 1962. I mean, military dictatorships in the early 1960s in Asia were no big thing. I mean, almost all of Burma's neighbors, except for China, which is communist, were military dictatorships, and some of them actually did some things that were good for the people of their country. But in the Burma case, General Ne Win and his Revolutionary Council undertook a whole series of disastrous decisions. They nationalized all major businesses, industry, banking, and basically shut off the economy from the rest of the world. No inward investment was allowed. Very little international trade was allowed. And all aid programs were kicked. Almost all aid programs were kicked out of the country, and tourism was banned. Essentially, it wasn't until the 1970s that tourists were allowed in tiny numbers to come into the country at that time. They expelled 400,000 ethnic Indians. This is very much like Idi Amin's expulsion of Indians from Uganda in the late 1960s, but it's much less known. And the Indians had been a big part, for better or for worse, a big part of the urban, professional, modern class and business class in Burma at the time. And more than anything else, and the military also, rather than simply taking power and being a military government over an otherwise civilian state structure, actually slowly became the state even more than they had been in the 50s by undermining, weakening, or actually taking apart and abolishing all the different civilian structures that were there, whether it was the old British system of district administration, the courts, the universities, the civil service, everything. All these things were either undermined or abolished. And, you know, Burma still had a cadre of several hundred well-trained, British-trained civil servants, and all these guys were fired or exiled. Which would have been a huge blow to any developing country. It was a particularly bad blow to Burma at the time. And there was a whole mentality also within the army of isolation and wanting to be able to fight the civil war without civilian interference, without foreign interference, was probably their paramount reason for isolating the country. But second, and probably the worst reason, was that Ne Win himself, I think, imbibed a kind of colonial prejudice that the Burmese are a nice people, but they can't really govern themselves, and they need time and tutelage, and it's better that they have this kind of space and this bubble in which they can learn to do things for themselves. So that was another reason. And the third and probably only good reason, in a way, for isolating the country was in the early 1960s. The Vietnam War expanding quickly, and it would spill over into neighboring countries, and China was on the verge of the Cultural Revolution. So this was seen as a safety thing as well, that in a way Burma could so easily be drawn into a China-US conflict, and by isolating it, perhaps it afforded a degree of protection. So there was good as well as bad reasons, but the net effect was a disaster, not just economically, but I would argue socially and mentally in many ways for Burmese society as well as for the Burmese army itself. So then if you fast forward to 1988, in the beginning of our current sort of Burma policy issues, you had a country which was already sick and tired of a quarter century of military rule and isolation, a country that was impoverished even more than it had been in 1962, and where at least the urban population was demanding some sort of change in policy, if not a change in government and a return to democracy. And the rest of that story is kind of well known on the outside, because the rest of that story, there's not much to tell. I mean, the military refused, essentially, and has tried to keep the status quo in place, making some cosmetic changes in terms of, you know, having a convention for a new constitution, releasing some political prisoners, entering into some talks with Aung San Suu Kyi. But essentially, they have worked hard to try to maintain the status quo politically. But what's unknown is generally two or three other things that have changed a lot since 1988, which is almost completely unreported on the outside. The first is that the Civil War, for the first time since 1948, has probably come closer to an end. In 1989, for reasons completely autonomous of the democracy movement and political change at the center, the Burmese army's number one battlefield enemy, which was the Burma Communist Party, imploded through an internal mutiny up near the Chinese border. They had at that time 22,000 or so very well-armed, very well-trained troops, and they splintered off into a number of successor ethnic minority-based militia. And the Burmese government reversed its four-decade-long policy of essentially looking for just a military solution to the armed conflict and instead negotiated ceasefires with the successor militia. And the taking the Burma Communist forces out of the equation meant that the Burmese army was then able to turn their guns against all the remaining insurgencies and one by one either pressure or persuade them also to agree to ceasefires, with one exception, which is the Karens in the southeast. And so by the mid-1990s, for the first time, the guns had gone silent almost everywhere in the country. There has been no progress towards a sustainable, just peace. But the fact that the fighting has almost stopped is it actually an incredibly important development in Burmese politics. The last change is that the army guys, when they took over, the new generation of army guys who took over after 1988, were no Democrats. I think few, if any of them, were actually interested in any kind of meaningful transition to democratic government. But many of them were interested in some kind of opening up to the rest of the world, some sort of ending of isolation. They looked to their peers in the military in Thailand and South Korea and Indonesia and wanted to get rich from business and engage with the West and the rest of the world. I remember when I was in 1987, when I was having coffee with a young army officer, he said to me, you know, the thing is we want to move from being an isolated left-wing military dictatorship to a pro-American right-wing military dictatorship. And you know, that kind of feeling infused a lot of the army in the early 90s, and so they embarked on these sort of slightly half-baked and sometimes half-hearted, certainly tentative steps towards economic reform, liberalizing a lot of the economy, a lot of social life, allowing inward investment for the first time, encouraging international trade, encouraging tourism. And that has had, in its own way, some effect on Burmese society. I mean, Burmese society is a very young society. It's 55, 56 million people. Half are under the age of 18. I was in Rangoon just a few months ago. There are now internet cafes, which are very heavily censored on political websites related to Burma, but they're there for all kinds of other things, satellite dishes everywhere. So there is a whole new generation of young people growing up, certainly in political repression and without any space for political dissent, but also have still a very lively cultural scene, art scene, music scene, all these things that I think are important to remember when trying to get a full picture of Burma today as well. So in kind of then trying to get back to our questions and sort of concluding, you know, by 2000, 2007 today, my point is really just to show that it's an incredibly complex picture, and it's not just this democracy problem that somehow needs to be solved, but this democracy problem needs to be seen within this broader context of a whole slew of even deeper problems and challenges that have been plaguing the country for a very long time, and certainly since 1962. You have the question of how to reach a sustainable end to the civil war. I mean, some of these insurgent groups are nothing better than militia for narcotics warlords. Some genuinely represent ethnic minority peoples and their grievances in their areas. But how do we end this war? And, you know, we all know how hard it is to end one single insurgency in a country. This is 18, 19 separate insurgencies over an area about the size of Great Britain, if not bigger. We have a situation where, because of sanctions and boycotts, Burma is still fairly isolated from contact in the West, but where there's an opening up in the region to the region, and Chinese influence, for better or for worse, is increasing rapidly every day through trade and through other types of contact as well. But you also have lots of other contacts within the region. I mean, I'm surprised in Rangoon, you know, people are watching Korean soap operas, watching Bollywood films, listening. I mean, there's a lot of sort of intra-regional contact and influence on Burma as well. You have the ongoing repression, which is as bad as at any time in the past. You had briefly, from about 2000 to 2004, a slightly more reformist group of army officers in charge who did try to negotiate with Aung San Suu Kyi, who did allow the ICRC to visit prisons, who allowed humanitarian aid to be expanded in the country and all these things. But then they were rolled back by the more senior army people in charge. And finally, you have two things. Finally, you have this withering away of state institutions, where it's a long process, but at this point now, the last generation, that was the civilians who were actually trained in the 1950s, who had scholarships to America, who were in their top positions, they're all retiring now. And you have nothing below them in terms of capacity. So you will soon have a governance structure where you have the army, which is still very professional in many ways, and nothing else around them, even more than in times in the past. And finally, to say a couple of words about the army itself. You know, what is it? I mean, it is, in many ways, a big bureaucracy. It's an expanded bureaucracy. It's gone from 180,000 to 440,000 soldiers. It's then one of the biggest armies in the world. And you have a whole generation of army officers now in their 40s who are battalion commanders who are being promoted up, in their 50s going to be promoted up to the top ranks in the army, who have basically achieved senior status in the 17, 18 years since 1988, and who've been promoted up because they're basically safe pairs of hands. I mean, these are safe pairs of hands. They've been promoted up because they haven't caused problems. They're good at clearing their inbox. They're good at solving problems on logistics and other things, helping to manage this big expansion of the army. And they've played the right game in terms of promotions and stuff within the bureaucracy. But they have no political vision. They have a mentality which has grown up in 40 years of isolation. They have a mentality that is innately distrustful of the outside world, which thinks that they need desperately to catch up with China and now even Vietnam economically, but have no clue in terms of how to do it, and are paranoid about Western intervention. But otherwise, they have these feelings, but they have no vision and no strategy. So then what do you do? The short answer is I have no idea. I don't know. But I think my point is, you know, there is no easy answer. And I think simply turning to a new round of heightened condemnation and looking at ways to tighten sanctions at a time when Western leverage and influence is very, very small anyway, and you're never going to get the Chinese to buy into sanctions on a country to promote democracy. I think energy would be better spent looking at some slightly more creative approaches which take in the whole range of different challenges and issues, but looking at first steps rather than a magic bullet or a grand strategy. And my concluding thing is to say that, you know, the clock is ticking in a way, though. There is a danger. There is a danger of a failed state in Burma. There is the danger that the top couple of guys will die or go away. You'll have a new army officer in charge. He won't be able to hold things together in the army the way these guys have. You have no other state institutions to act as a ballast in that society. If you have the army fall apart, it will fall apart into its 14, 15 regional commands. You will have 17, 18 different insurgencies going back to a war footing, and you will have a failed state in the heart of Asia, which would be a disaster for the region at a time when China and India are both doing so well in many ways. So I'll leave it at that, and very happy to answer questions.
Great. Thanks very much. Why don't we just raise your hand, Johanna?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the same way that I think, it's best to have a more informed discussion outside, I think it's also be great if the military itself could have a more informed discussion inside. And sadly, I don't think they do. They do control the foreign service and the foreign ministry of the country. They've replaced many experienced or, you know, civilian diplomats with army personnel. And from everything I can tell, especially in the last few years, they are more isolated in terms of not receiving, not receiving information from the outside, because they can all, at the senior level, can all look at the internet and read things. But very few of them now speak English or can read English. They simply do not have the analytical setup to take in kind of information, much less try to access what might be out there. And to paraphrase, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, I mean, they don't know what they don't know. They have no sense of, you know, what lessons there might be out there which could at least help them almost in a way have their cake and eat it too in terms of a managed transition that in which they would be okay. No, partly because, well, there would be three, but they have a long time ago, in the 50s, Burma was part of a couple of small peace operations. There would be two problems in that. One is that they have expanded because they feel that they need the 400,000 plus troops for internal security and to keep the strong hand against the ceasefire groups until they've actually disbanded them and demobilized them, which I think is probably a long ways off. The second is, I think from the UN side or something, it would be very difficult to take troops, including troops from battalions that may be easily be guilty of serious human rights violations in the country. So, you know, I don't think it's an impossible. It's not something we shouldn't look at, but I think it would be a very difficult proposition.
Yes, sir. Yes, I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council. 40 years ago, when ASEAN was formed, Burma was not a member, but now, along with Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, it is a member. Does ASEAN have any influence whatsoever on Burma these days? There are some who argue that, you know, that is the right approach to use the influence of its peers, but most people seem to think...
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there's a kind of people-to-people or social-level influence, I guess, with the opening up of trade to ASEAN. There's influences culturally and in other ways. But at a political level, I think it's next to zero. If an ASEAN foreign minister of an ASEAN minister comes into Burma and says, you know, can you help us with this bilateral problem or can you help us with this issue or why don't you try this, they might listen. But if it's about the core issue of political change in the country, which they see simply as an outside conspiracy, a regime change and unseating them, it'll have no more influence than anybody else. And it's not as if, you know, going back a little bit to Joanna's point, it's not as if the Burmese look up to any of these ASEAN countries. They don't look up to any other. I mean, they think that they are the best army in the world. They think they are, you know, the best, the toughest. They've been fighting the longest. They are a professional force. So they don't look up, actually, to the Thai army or the Indonesian army. I think the countries that have a degree of influence would be China and India. But China much more than India. China because, you know, the Burmese have been dependent in terms of trade and diplomatic protection from the Chinese since the early 1990s. India much less because it's a much more recently evolved relationship where I think India has been as much the suitor as the Burmese. I mean, the Indians want a strong relationship. But I don't think, you know, if, again, both these countries, I suppose if they went to the Burmese on specific points, maybe the Burmese would say, okay, you know, you're friends and we'll do this and that. But if it's on the core issue of why don't you start thinking about handing over power to civilians, I don't think it's going to get anywhere.
Yes. Frank Dahl, George Washington University. You sort of tease us a little bit about China's influence. I can't help feeling that China must have, whether it's admitted or not, a tremendous influence on current thinking in Burma. And could you elaborate that a little on that a little more?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Sorry, was there a second?
Basically,
point? Yeah.
Penetration by the Chinese because there must be Chinese commercial interests and all sorts of things. Natural resources and all this.
It depends what you mean by influence. I mean, there's certainly a lot of influence in the sense that the Chinese are very much present. They're a big part of Burma's foreign trade structure. The Chinese have a big embassy. They talk to the Burmese at different levels. How much they're actually using that and on what issues, other than purely bilateral and border and trade issues, I don't know. But I don't see any sign that the Chinese... my guess is, and it's almost purely a guess, is that the Chinese certainly don't really care about democracy in Burma, but they probably want... Their analysis is probably that this setup is not sustainable and it needs to move towards a more sustainable system with at least greater civilian participation. And if it's a democracy, okay. If it's not, fine with us. Whether or not they're actually engaging the Burmese on those issues at the top level, I would be surprised. I don't see any sign of it, but it's not impossible. But the short answer is I don't know. But they certainly deal with the Burmese government at many levels, and they're certainly influential through their trade presence.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was interested that in your discussion you talked about the role of the Army extensively, the role of the ethnic strife, and actually some of your discourse reminded me a lot of the lectures we used to get from King Young about how everything the government did was justified by the ethnic situation. But you didn't talk a lot about the will of the people and their interest in democracy. And when I was there in 1995, it was just after Aung San Suu Kyi had been released, and she would give speeches over the gate of her compound, and there would be 10,000 people in the street on all sides of University Boulevard, crammed in there, listening to every word she said. It went on for a few months, and they shut it down. But it was palpable at that time, and Marilyn can verify that there was really a tremendous upwelling of feeling in the people to bring democracy to the country. I wonder how you assess how that feeling for democracy is playing out now, how it can be put into the political situation. Also, do you feel that Burma is ready for democracy, even if the people want it? Maybe it's something that...
Yeah. Well, first, I mean, I think that the popular desire for some kind of democratic government, and certainly not a military government, is almost a starting point. I mean, we saw this in 88. 88 was an incredibly passionate outpouring of... and people willing to take to the streets and die by their hundreds to ask for a change of government. So in a way, that's the starting point of the problem. I don't think in a way that's diminished. And I think Aung San Suu Kyi's latest travels in a few years ago to Mandalay and elsewhere showed the strength of popular feeling. I'm sure that if there was a snap election today, she would win the majority of votes. I think that's coupled to some extent with a degree of resignation by people because it's been a long time, and the government has made it very clear through its policies and its repression that its number one priority is preventing a return of a 1988 situation, where I think people actually did quite come close to overthrowing the government in many ways. And I think for many people it's a very depressing prospect that it's hard for them to see exactly how they can, on their own, through some sort of popular movement or something, change things or the thing. At the same time, having said that, I would say that if there is a way through popular protests or popular pressure to undermine the status quo in Burma, we won't be able to figure it out from here. I mean, in a way, it's for grassroots movements there, and I think in that way, the 88 generation student groups that have emerged now, I think are a much more potent force because they're much closer to the grassroots there. Than even the NLD leadership, which is quite old outside. I mean, not outside, but in Rangoon. So maybe it's possible, but I don't know to what extent. I think it's unlikely, given the harshness of the military's position right now, that they would give any space for that kind of thing to emerge. In terms of whether a transition to democracy is possible, I think that it's possible that some general will take power someday, 6 months from now, 6 years from now, who will be of a more liberal persuasion, or at least want to change things, enter into talks, even invite a civilian or an elected government to take power. I think it's even possible, I think it's a long stretch, that you could have another uprising which is successful. I think it's extremely likely it's possible. But then I guess the point of my talk is to show that even if that happened, let's say you had by miracle a democratic government or Aung San Suu Kyi in power, you have almost nothing, you would have one of the most... You would predict one of the most difficult transitions to a sustainable democracy imaginable because of the history of ethnic strife, because of the presence of so many armed groups still in the country, because of the lack of any kind of civilian institutions, because of the military, but whatever, that are there right now, and because of the deeply impoverished nature of the country and the economy as well. So it's not impossible, and it would be great if there's a democratic government tomorrow, but I think even if that happened, the army is still going to be there. They could still stage a coup 6 months later. It's going to be... an incredibly difficult transition.
That corner, yes. Also, member of National League for Democracy, two questions. What do you think about the 1990 multi-party general elections and then the National Convention led by the MDPG?
I think the 1990 elections, they were far from free and fair because there was so much harassment and restrictions before it happened. Aung San Suu Kyi herself was already not locked up, but under house arrest by the time the elections happened. There was many attempts to intimidate the National League for Democracy. But as a reflection of popular desire, I think it was a very clear indication of what that was. So I think it's less of a normal election. If you had a completely free election, you might have had other ethnic parties competing and getting seats. But in general, as a rejection of military rule and a desire for change and support for Aung San Suu Kyi. I think that was very clear in 1990. And as I just said, I think if there's another election, she would win again. I would guess that that's almost a certain thing. The government's own national convention, though, is on the one hand an easy thing to dismiss because it's really just an attempt by them to create, in the way the military created in 74 and 75, a civilian constitutional facade for what will be a continuation of a military-dominated, if not completely military-controlled system. The only caveat I have on that is that for some of the ethnic groups, the ceasefire groups, like the Kachin, for example, who I think do represent the ethnic peoples in their areas and grievances, they are in an impossible situation with this process. They have joined this process to some extent in good faith, hoping that it would lead to some degree of local autonomy, some participation in a more federal system of government. There are very little signs that that will be given, maybe some local autonomy agreements for some of these groups. It's easy for us to completely condemn it or reject whatever constitutional framework comes out, but for them, they're going to be in a very tight situation because either they participate in what will be a largely cosmetic exercise, or what do? If they leave that process, it'll almost be like they're going back to a war footing against the government. So with that little caveat in terms of their position being extremely difficult and worrisome and something to look out for, in general, I don't think even for the military the constitutional process is an important one. I think for the military the important thing is their own internal transition within the army in terms of who's going to take over in the army rather than any sort of actual change to the constitutional process.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
go
ahead. Super question.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm Rajesh Kedi and I've written extensively on South Asia. You said the population, half the population is below the age of 18. There's also 1.4% incidence of AIDS. Recruits, 1.3% incidence of AIDS. And there's this embargo on dealing. So how's the Burmese military and society dealing with AIDS? The second is slightly more complex, or very complex. The south of the country, borders were defined in 1909 by the Anglo-Chinese Treaty. Now, that is the region where the Muslim majorities of Thailand, Malaysia, or extremist Malaysia, and Burma coexist. And these are artificial borders there. And there's this, so where's the Islamic insurgency or fundamentalism?
Yeah. On the AIDS question, it took until the late 1990s or so, I can't remember exactly when, for the government to admit that there was an AIDS problem in the country, and it is, and Burma has the second highest incidence of HIV-AIDS infection in Asia, whatever the exact statistics. And the UN agencies and international NGOs have been doing increasing work in the limited space they've been given by the government to work on these issues. I think there are people in the government who are aware of the problem, others who probably don't care, are willing to dismiss it. I think that the more important bigger point on that is that the government has presided over a complete collapse of the healthcare system in the country and the education system in the country over two generations now. And this has all the hallmarks for a big disaster coming up. I mean, it's already a disaster for many people in many ways, but it's another thing that makes any kind of transition to a better kind of government more complex. The UN is holding up a lot of the health provisions that are there, which are not enough. 70-80% of the population do not have access to any kind of public health care. But this question of how to improve assistance for Burma on health or education, or even just providing emergency humanitarian food and other assistance, is a deeply difficult one. Because on the one hand, everyone, I think, would want to be able to help people in Burma. On the other hand, the government has imposed increasing rather than decreasing restrictions on aid going into the country. But I think it's an important one to think through and get right. Of how, you know, how is it possible to provide the right kinds of assistance in Burma at a time when parts of the country, not all the country, but parts of the country are facing almost emergency humanitarian situations on conditions on healthcare and even just food security as well. But I think we need to look at it objectively and look at what's possible and look at the lessons learned from recent UN and international NGO attempts in the country. Oh, sorry, and on the Muslims. Actually, the Muslim population in Burma is not in the south. It's not in the south near Malaysia and Thailand. There are four, I think four, three or four Muslim communities in Burma. There's the oldest, which is were known as Burmese Muslims, which are generally descended from Arabs, Persians, others who came to Burma over the last 1,000 years and speak Burmese and who settled in many different parts of the country and were important parts of Burmese society hundreds of years ago. You have the influx of Muslims from the subcontinent, from different parts of what is now India, Pakistan, Bangladesh during the British period. You had the Rohingyas who came from the Chittagong region into Arakan during the colonial period and who had been pushed out as refugees in the 1970s and 80s. And then finally, you have the most interesting Muslim population in Burma, which is the Yunnanese Muslim population. In the 1850s, there had been a big Muslim rising in Yunnan, which the Manchu government responded to with basically a genocidal policy, and tens of thousands of Yunnanese Muslims fled into Burma. So in Mandalay and the whole road from Mandalay to China, you find Yunnanese Muslims, Chinese mosques, people who speak basically Yunnanese form of Mandarin Chinese. The group that's been the most politicized of the Muslims are the Rohingyas. The conflict between them and the Buddhists Arakanese in the west of the country near Bangladesh began around World War II. And the Burmese military have basically supported the Buddhists against the Muslims. And that's where in their camps and refugee camps on the Bangladesh side of the border as well, there have always been allegations of ties to foreign Islamic groups and radical groups and violent groups. But I'm not an expert on it. I don't know exactly what's true and what's not in terms of their relations to outside Islamic radical groups.
Yes, sir. Back bencher.
All right. Go ahead.
Just a question. We're talking about the army. And the first question I had, because I basically answered, you said there was sort of this rollback in 2004, 2005, Fanchway. It became stronger. Kenya got sidelined. My question was going to be, can you see anybody coming along? And I think I'm going to let you answer that, but the second part of that, any of the army officers now who basically you say have risen up from the rice paddies and in their local areas and so on, any sort of education outside the country in any other military?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of political science or, diplomacy, interacting in other ways.
Yeah, the first part of the question in terms of, you know, could there be another sort of Kenyan figure emerging anytime soon? I think it's unlikely, and I think in a way there was an opportunity there when he was pushing forward certain reforms to try to protect at least what had happened and expand it, and that was missed. And I think it'll be very difficult even to get back to that situation where you have a government that's interested in some kind of dialogue, both with the opposition in Rangoon, with Aung San Suu Kyi, and also with the outside world. In terms of the guys who are there right now, I guess the answer is no. You know, the army officers, some of them now receive training in China. Perhaps they receive training in some other Asian countries, I'm not quite sure. But they're certainly not getting training in political science or history or anything. Many of them, though, are graduates of their own defense academy, the defense academy up in Mimeo, where they get the equivalent of a college degree, where they do have to learn. You know, but the history courses and whatever are going to be extremely narrow and very biased, and in many ways it will further entrench the kind of thinking process in the military about the past and what's possible in the future. I know someone who teaches an economics class there that all the young lieutenant colonels have to pass to get their colonelcy, and he teaches them about reforms in China and Vietnam and economic issues and stuff. And he said they're all intrigued by this, and they all say, you know, why can't we be like that? What's the problem? What do we need to do? So, you know, the ones who are going up in the fort, there's an interest, but almost everything is stacked against them in them then becoming someone who's actually going to have a vision to lead the military in a different direction. So, you know, at some level, there is an interest. And I think there's a pervasive curiosity in Burma about how is it that Burma has now fallen so far behind its neighbors, and what can be done about that. And there's a nationalist feeling across the board that we simply cannot fall further behind than China and India the way we have. I mean, in a way, Burma's future is clear, right? It's going to be a small country between India and China. And as India and China grow, it's going to get caught up and integrated into that expansion. The question is whether the Burmese are going to get caught up into that as second-class citizens exporting raw material and cheap labor, or as first-class citizens in a partnership with these countries. And, you know, I think there's a great desire by, I think, people across the board, including the Army, to get that that part of the question right, but I don't think anyone in the Army has the imagination to know how to do it.
Yes, sir.
No,
okay. Let me, Gene Martin. Following on to what you just said about China's influence, interest by younger officers on what China and India think of China's view, it would seem to me that China could perhaps have influence on these officers to be able to encourage them along the line, not on the political point of view, but more China has gone very far in political life, but economic importance, certainly. That would, I think, help a lot in terms of social peace and social progress. The other thing is, you mentioned you obviously go back and forth very regularly. I think most of the Burmese diaspora is not well received, shall we say, in Europe. But there are people like you and others, I think, who do go back and forth and do have a dialogue. What sort of reception do you get? And do you have any influence in that sense?
Yeah.
Do you have an opportunity to sort of
yeah.
with people?
Yeah.
Share ideas.
Yeah, it's not actually the case that people don't. I mean, there are many people who go back and forth because there are different parts of the diaspora, and there are people who've left for political reasons. They became refugees. They have no Burmese documents. They went abroad. There are a lot of people who have been given passports and who've traveled, work abroad, come back, have family. Remittances are now an increasingly big part of the Burmese economy. People are the latest thing in Rangoon is people going to Dubai in the Middle East for construction jobs and things like that. I just go back for personal reasons. I mean, I see friends. I was in exile from 88 until 96. I go back, and I've always said I'm just going back to see friends and family. I travel around the country just to get a sense of, you know, conditions and things. But mostly I'm not in any kind of contact with the government in that way. Whether people like me who go in and out can influence, I suppose so. But I think it's very unclear how open. See, well, let me put it this way. I think anyone in the Burmese government who actually reaches out, in the Burmese army who actually reaches out and says, oh, I'm going to talk to these Burmese who've been abroad or this, they're going to be in a lot of trouble right now. And they'd be less likely to do it now than ever before, partly because of what happened to Kim Yunt and his people in the intelligence services, but also because they know a time of transition. From a purely careerist perspective, it's a good time to keep their heads down, or at least show team spirit on this stuff. So they're not going to stick their necks out. So even if it was possible at a different time, I think it would be very difficult to find interlocutors for even an informal dialogue in that way.
Bill Nash from the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you very much. A little bit more on the military. First of all, a legacy issue, late 40s through the 50s, who was the model? What did they follow to become so proficient?
Yeah.
And then going back to the relationship with China, are there other mill-to-mill contacts of any size that provides a view? And I would just comment about the China thing. Not only is it an economic model, but there is civilian control of the military.
Yeah, absolutely.
In China.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the big difference in China and Burma's political style, I mean, China is a communist country that came to power through a communist revolution, and there's a history of civilian control which doesn't exist in Burma at all. And in Burma there's a long history of distrust of any civilian technocrats or educated people. On the second part of the question, because it's a more speculative answer, other than China, I mean, I think Burma maintains contacts with Singapore, with India now, their increased defense contacts as well. I'm not sure exactly in terms of training and things like that. There's also a long history of contacts with Israel. Going back to the late 1940s and 1950s, it's very interesting because the army under Ne Win was fighting this counterinsurgency battle. They'd managed to get on top of it when Chiang Kai-shek's remnant KMT forces came down from Yunnan under General Li Mi, and were supported by the CIA at that time, and almost kicked out the government out of a huge area of territory. It was at that point that the Burmese decided that they had to build up this professional force. And there was a group of young colonels who, ironically, many of whom are the senior members of the NLD right now, who went shopping around for models and ideas. And they went everywhere. They went to the US, UK, USSR, Australia for special forces training and ideas, from guerrilla insurgency ideas, to Israel and to Yugoslavia, primarily, both in terms of equipment and hardware, but also in terms of how to set up the War Office professionally, how to set up the Army, all these things. And so they picked and they chose and they came up with their own model. That's one answer. The other part is there is a line, though, that still goes back to the Japanese training as well during World War II, at least in terms of ethos and certain basic ideas and training, because many of those same colonels were people who had initially been trained during World War II by Japanese instructors.
Yes, sir. My name is Kunio Kikuchi. I work for Masaoka Associates. Masaoka is actually an American company. He is an American. The only Japanese you mentioned is about World War II. What about current relationships with Japan? I go to Tokyo 3-4 times a year, and I notice that my favorite noodle shops, more and more of them have Burmese ladies working, and they have been there for quite a few years, and I imagine they bring back information about how things are in Tokyo to their home.
Yeah.
And in that sense, definitely information about the outside world is seeping through. My question is, what about the internet?
Yeah.
What about that kind of information?
Yeah.
And what is the end game if this current situation of unrestricted military, bureaucracy control continues? What happens?
Yeah. First, in terms of the internet, because I go to internet cafes in Rangoon and try to get onto different websites and stuff. So it's very clear. I mean, the main, you know, Burmese exile websites, political websites directed on Burma are all censored pretty easily. I mean, they're blocked. It is possible, if you go to the right internet cafe, to kind of get around certain restrictions and get onto email accounts and things that the government tries to block. Every other thing on music and culture and stuff is generally fairly open and increasingly open. They're exponentially more internet cafes now than there were, say, 2 years ago. And people know. I mean, in general, the part of the reason people dislike this government so much is they know what's going on in the rest of the world. And there's satellite dishes everywhere and VCRs and DVDs and whatever. And people have and this huge diaspora. I mean, there are well over a million people who've left Burma, many of whom go back routinely as well. Not just people who make it out of Japan, but also very, very poor people into the sex industry in Thailand, for example, and back. And this has been a big problem in terms of the AIDS problem. In terms of Japanese influence, I think it's much less than it was 15 years ago for two reasons. The first is that the last generation of people who had been in the war and had trained with the Japanese, and people like General Ne Win, who still had many contacts in Japan because of his wartime experience, the Japanese Veterans Association, are dead or have long retired. And so that sentimental tie, that personal tie. The second is that Japan was one of Burma's biggest aid donors in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, and now it's not. And so that leverage through aid is so Japan is much overshadowed in terms of an important player in the Burmese economy by China and also even by some other countries. So I think the net influence of Japan is much less than it was, and the perception in Burma of Japan being having important leverage is much less than it was 20 years or even 15 years ago, I think.
okay, I've had two trips to Burma as a tourist in 1994 and again in 2001. And I appreciate, I mean, I haven't been involved in the politics of it, but I've been able to travel in Rangoon and Mandalay and Bagan. And the culture that I experienced, I mean, it was like the people were very kind, and you know, I met many people that spoke English, and if they don't speak English, like in the markets, I mean, I felt tremendous freedom, you know, going about in the markets and, you know, places. The crafts are absolutely beautiful, you know, the weaving is spectacular. Then to the Bagan Lacquerware Institute, where the students come from all over the world to study lacquerware. So, you know, my question would be, like, maybe the civil institutions have not survived, but do you feel that, the arts and this type of culture, and I've seen, like, the dancing of the Mahabharata and the magnificent costumes, do you think that there's a strength of the Burmese culture and the arts that can, in some sense,
I think so, and also even in religious life as well, and you see that Buddhism is still extremely vibrant today. I think so, and I'd like to think so. I think, though, that they're facing increasingly difficult odds because in many parts of the country, many people are getting poorer. I think the problems that I mentioned before of healthcare and education are straining even the resources of people who would otherwise then spend full time in the arts or something else. So, I guess my answer is, it's an incredibly complex country. You can go to one part of the country, like in the eastern part of the Karen state on the Thai border, where it's still a war situation. There's massive displacement of people, where there are refugees going into Thailand, where there's violent counterinsurgency, violent fighting as well. You can go to another part of Burma where it's completely peaceful. Actually, the economy is not bad there. Maybe some of the bridges and roads the government have built have made a difference. And then you can go to another part which is heavily under government control, but there's a humanitarian emergency purely because of economic mismanagement. So it's a very, I guess my big point is that it's a very diverse country. And that's why there's probably not even a single sort of answer in terms of what needs to be done to do these different things. But I think you're right in the sense that, even though civilian state institutions are very weak, in some ways, despite again all the odds, there is still a fairly vibrant, it's not really civil society, but a sort of Burmese society in many ways. And it's a very young country, as I said, and I think there's a whole set of things that we don't really know in terms of what's going on in many parts of the country, apart from the army and politics.
Yes, sir. I'm Lex Rieta from the Brookings Institution. I spent 2 weeks in Myanmar 18 months ago. And I came away with the impression that the influence of China or the role of China in the economy and the political life of the country was increasing as rapidly as the Chinese economy. Mm.
Mm. Well, but there's two. I would add two other factors, right? Both of which are bad for Burma in a way. One is that if it gets integrated into China, there's an aspect of an economic boom in China because of trade and investment coming from China. The Burmese are doing this from a very hobbled position because they don't have the basic social services, especially education and healthcare, that would allow them to compete. Burmese businessmen, even and even basic law and order institutions that would allow them to compete properly with Chinese aid, Chinese businessmen in the country. The second is that if the Chinese tried to leverage that influence and position and power in Burma into trying to influence the Burmese, even on economic issues, let alone political issues, I think they will be up against a fairly still hard-headed Burmese military, which has a history of resenting any attempts by the outside world to tell them what to do. Maybe if it was couched in the right way and was clearly limited to economic management issues and rule of law issues, maybe. But I think certainly if it strayed into issues of political reconciliation, I think it would be very, very difficult.
Well, but that was not quite my point. My point was I don't think the Chinese
want to do that.
A policy
right.
To take over
yeah.
Burma, or need a policy
right.
To try and take over
right.
Burma.
Right.
But it seems to me that just by
right.
doing tomorrow what they did yesterday.
Yeah.
I
think that's right, and I think that connects with the question about the end game, which is, what does that mean? Let's say nothing happened from Washington, right, or nothing happened from the UN or the outside world. I think the default situation is that Burma gets pulled into the Chinese and Indian economy, in part in a good way, in the sense that, maybe that will lead to economic growth. I mean, Burma, the big difference in the Burmese economy today than in 10 years ago is that they've also discovered tens of billions of dollars worth of natural gas. But if that happens at a time when there are no proper economic policies in place by the government and economic management and health and education, all these things, it's easy to see a situation in which the ordinary Burmese people still lose out in many ways, and you have the development of an essentially foreign Chinese business class in the country, resentment against them. You could have all kinds of problems down the road. And if the army doesn't adopt more enlightened positions at that point, you will also, you could still have this very rapid withering away of other kinds of state capacities as well, and an inability to keep things together, especially if the growth leads to growing inequities in the country or inequalities in the country between rich people and poor people, I think. But I think that would certainly be a bad scenario in terms of what would happen. But I agree with you in general that if nothing happened, the part of the equation about Burma being pulled into China's economic, I think it's a given almost.
What I wanted to do is to link this to the new capital.
Oh.
Because there have been reports that the government used the money from China to build the capital, and the Chinese are not happy about that. And I'm not sure that either part of that report is true.
I don't know. But to be honest, I don't know. It's possible. I mean, they used private construction companies in Burma. We're very close to the military, some of the senior generals, whether in some way this is related to some business, Chinese business deal or Chinese bank loans. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, and that's not kind of a thing that I know very well. I was also, a novice monk in Burma when I was a teenager. But I think in general, it's hard to see the Sangha, the Buddhist monks, being drawn into politics in a very direct way. I mean, for a couple of reasons. I mean, they were very politicized in the British period. Many people don't necessarily want to, even people who don't like the government don't necessarily want monks to be political. And also the government would hate that to happen, so there'll be extreme repression against any monks who try to enter into politics. But I take your broader point about the culture, but I would add a kind of complexity to it, because I think it's true that in Burma, certain obedience and stuff is a virtue, and people like to kind of, follow a certain line. But there's also the other flip side of Burmese culture, which is not an anarchist desire, but there's also a very rebellious streak in Burmese culture. It's not necessarily the same person, but, two different streaks in the culture. And so you have a long history of people who don't like things, and they set up their own insurgency. They go underground in some way. They splinter off and form their own group. I mean, there's a very strong... It's very different from Thai culture in that way. I don't want to make gross generalizations about different Asian cultures, but I think Thailand has a much stronger culture of sort of compromise and deal-making and sort of gray areas, whereas in Burma, I think across the board, it's not just in the military. Maybe the military is rarefied in a certain way. There's a very strong sense that this is right, wrong, black, white. I don't like this. I'm going to go form my own group, go off into the hills and whatever. And so there's that as well as the kind of that other aspect of the culture as well. So, I mean, I guess those are important things to think about. I don't know if it helps in any way, though, in terms of what might come next.
First of all, there's a
I think that, you know, on the last point, I think it's not so much that the government thinks that the military, the army thinks that by keeping the country poor, it's going to help them, because it won't help them, actually. I mean, I think a deeply impoverished country would be in some ways harder to govern. I think it's more that it doesn't fit on their radar. I don't think they care. I think very few care. I think there's some people in the army who probably think, I don't want democracy, but I want a better economy and to be able to compete with China and stuff. But a lot of them, it's not part of their day-to-day work. It's not part of their worldview to really be thinking very hard about what's the welfare in this particular township and how can we improve it. I think in terms of, you know, the statistics you get, I mean, 1 million refugees is a lot of people. There are about 1 million Burmese in Thailand at most, but nobody has accurate statistics on who's there. And only some of them are fleeing the fighting. Many of them are economic migrants as well. I think it's true that there is a long record of very severe human rights abuses conducted in the course of counterinsurgency campaigns. I think, however, you know, awful the situation is in the center of the country in terms of 1,000 political prisoners, I think throughout the last 20, 30 years, the worst human rights abuses occur in the conduct of the civil war. And to the extent that that fighting has stopped in most of the country, that's better for a lot of people. It's still continuing in this one part of the country against the Karen in the southeast, and I think it's important to continue to monitor that and take it very seriously. But I think we shouldn't miss the bigger picture, which is that we need somehow to also have a strategy for keeping the ceasefires that are there in place, because the worst thing would be if the fighting resumed in some other part of the country, because you can bet that, you know, the government's going to have a, you know, bloody counterinsurgency campaign there too. And I think there needs to be a better, bigger focus on Burma as a peace-building challenge as well as a political transition challenge. In terms of intent, yeah, I mean, the government wants to beat the insurgents, but I really don't get the sense of that the government has some great strategic brain at the top that's kind of deciding all these things. I see it more as a machine that is producing often very awful policies, but as part of this machine. It really, you know, a lot of people waited for 20 years for General Ne Win to die, and then he died, and then nothing happened. Because he's left behind a machine that produces a certain mentality, a certain set of policies, a certain type of parameters, and it's about unlocking that as much as hoping that, you know, some savior within the military is going to come up and shift course 180 degrees. I think in terms of day-to-day repression, the only thing I'll say is, the intelligence services were completely dismantled 2 years ago when General Kenyatta was overthrown, and in a perverse way, even though he was leading a sort of reformist faction within the government, there is very little day-to-day surveillance in Rangoon right now, or at least when I was there, because all the intelligence people were locked up. And Rangoon is in a weird way freer than it was 2 years before because of that. And a lot of people tell you, shopkeepers, other people will say that. So, but I'm sure they'll try to rebuild the system. But in the short term, they don't have the kind of network and intelligence system that they had until October of 2004. I think the repression affects people differently. You know, there are many people from many families who have a long history of trying to resist the military dictatorship. They've been under surveillance. They have relatives who've been locked up. They themselves have been locked up. And then there are other people who have never touched politics and generally live day to day without thinking about it. So again, my point is, it's a very diverse and very complex country, and it would be wrong to paint any kind of. I think the common thing is it's a mess across the board in many ways, but I think, you know, there, it's very different in different parts of the country and in different parts of Burmese society. Yeah, I think I have two answers. One is the pessimistic or the opposite. I think that my pessimistic answer is that, you know, the more I kind of think about it, and especially thinking about what's happened the last couple of years since the arrest of General Quinones and everything, the more I think in some ways any effort to either pressure this government or to try to persuade this government through engagement, at least at the kind of anemic level that both of these things have happened, are almost doomed to failure. I mean, these guys are locked into a certain nature and a certain way of doing things. It's hard for me to imagine the political will coming up in the West for some senior political leader to say, it's risky, but I'm going to risk my whole political career on helping Burma, to do what it's going to take in terms of serious diplomacy and the mix of carrots and sticks to actually try to change. I think it's very unlikely. That all being said, you know, as a Burmese, I would hope that it could be tried. And I think, you know, it's not about sanctions or engagement or whatever. It's really about a more dynamic and clever strategy, which actually takes into consideration all the kinds of things that I've been trying to talk about. But it would, in the end, the missing, the vital ingredient is political. I mean, somebody has to actually be interested in doing it. And, you know, the default thing of just raising the temperature in terms of statements of condemnation from far away, coupled with, you know, boycotts and stuff, I don't think that's going to do it. It hasn't done the trick. I don't think it's going to do the trick. You know, I think the condemnation is not unimportant, because I think one part of any human rights strategy has to be to identify, monitor, and speak out on human rights abuses. But the other part of it has to be coming up with a realistic strategy for then changing things. And I think, you know, the last thing I'll say on that is I think any approach has to look at has to start with the way things really are on the ground, and has to look at realistic first steps rather than looking for a magic formula, which sadly doesn't exist.
Last few minutes. Can I see how many questions are left out here? And let's see if we can. It looks like there are four. So why don't we just go one, two, three, four? Could you ask your questions quickly and we'll give them yes or no answer? Two or four.
In the 1970s, I was involved in negotiating with Yamal for the Gulf of Mariaman oil exploration projects. At that time, I found a very impressive group of young engineers, technicians running novel oil.
Mm-hmm.
They negotiated, they were put by the government into terrible problems to negotiate, but they were very honest, they were very straightforward, very professional, very impressive. What's happened to people like that? Are there any more coming on? Is that
Unfortunately, not many more coming on. I think the problem is that, you know, many of these guys who may have been in their 30s and 40s at that time as I said before, you know, reaching retirement age or have passed retirement age. And sadly, this was the last generation that was educated abroad. You know, some people continue to be educated abroad, and there's some very small scholarship programs going into the 80s and even today. But, you know, the stream is very, very small right now. And so you're going to have a huge you're already having the beginning of a huge downturn in capacity. You know, you still have very good people in the Burmese bureaucracy who would be good in any bureaucracy, but it's a tiny number of but it's a tiny number of people who are left right now, and the ones who are left are eager just to get their pension and get out of this game.
Yes, sir. I'm Mark Sundberg with World Bank. Ron, I really enjoyed the presentation, but it's also, I think, depressing. We're all
thanks, Dad.
Or fragile states is the term used more frequently. And it poses an enormous problem globally. Maybe 30 countries fall into that class. Post-conflict, imploding governments, a number of different categories of problems. But with huge global consequences, cross-border problems, disease, terrorism, and anything.
Yeah.
The sort of simple answer to how we approach countries like this, and it's a strategic issue we're debating now and trying to think through more clearly because of the problem, is that you cannot deal with the government. The judiciary oversight is absent, the trust of mechanisms and institutions in place is absent. So as an alternative, one searches for other entry points through NGOs, if they're allowed in, through ring-fence humanitarian projects. But often that's not possible as well, particularly if you have a regime that opposes it. Are there institutions that are non-governmental or that are super-governmental? Are there entry points that are more trusted for some historical or other reason?
Yeah.
Or coalitions that can be built? What are points that you see that could get into the table?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give a pessimistic answer. I think it's possible, but I think if there were and they became the recipients of large amounts of outside aid, they would become targeted by the military for some kind of co-optation in some way. So I think it'll be hard. having said that, I think it's worth trying and looking because, you know, again, it's a big country, it's complex. You never know, right? And I think it's worth looking for ways in which you can deliver assistance and help in the right way, which won't compromise any basic international standards on that. But I think what you said made me think of something, which is, you know, I think there are two real policy choices, right? And it depends on your analysis and your judgment. One policy choice is to think some kind of democratic transition is still very possible and very necessary, and whatever political will can be mustered should be focused on that, even if it's very high risk. And then if you go down that path, you have to think that that is both possible in terms of the political will you need and to get the Chinese on board and everybody else, and knowing what kind of transition is going to come up. The other is to say that's actually not realistic, and it's better to put that on the side and try to get the government to put in place a whole series of other policies that would actually allow for the right type of engagement that actually move things forward. They're two very different. They're both very problematic, but I think that's in a way the way you have to come down. Either you think that democracy should still be the focus, or you think that you leave that aside for now because it's not going anywhere, and you look for a way to kind of outflank the problem and try to move towards ways in which it would be possible, in a way that's not now, to do proper aid and assistance in the country. But both are going to be very tough. Yeah, I believe what I said about what I think the military thinks. And it's based on talking to people in the country at length for a very long period of time. I think that the problem is, you know, with the ethnic minorities, I don't think anyone can claim to speak for the ethnic minorities as a whole. And if you go there...
I'm saying what they say themselves.
But who's they? I mean, there's 15 million ethnic minorities in the country. 15 million ethnic minorities in the country.
That's what the military regime says right there. But they say, no, actually, it's not that many. There's only 8 major ethnic groups. And yes, there are smaller subsets, but they do put forth nuanced policy positions that they get together and agree on. So that's what I'm saying. It sounds like an embassy speech, but not like...
No, but the question is, who speaks for these groups? I mean, is it the Kokang army who speaks for the Kokang people in that region? You know, is it the KIO? I think the KIO do speak to a large extent for the Kachins. And this is what I was saying is the big problem. The Kachins were one of the biggest armed groups in the country. They agree to a ceasefire. They're part of this national convention. They're saying they want to stay as part of it. They're saying they have problems, they want to stay. Do we listen to their lead or something else? Because they're in a very hemmed-in position. They can't exactly say what they think. They're in a very difficult position in terms of saying what they actually feel because they're trying to go along with a very difficult military process. So who speaks for the Kachin? And I think it's a problem for all these different groups. I think it's very difficult to say, you know, exactly. I mean, the democracy movement itself, you have the NLD, which won the elections in 1990. The government has decimated a lot of their organization inside the country. As I said before, the vast majority of people, I think, desperately want change in the country. But that's the starting point, right? The question is, what do we do practically that will change things? And I think we need to start by saying, okay, well, we know it's terrible. We can all debate about how terrible it is. But then the question is, what can you do next? And I've grown up, you know, I was born in 1966. My whole life has been surrounded by people condemning the government. I mean, this was the starting point. We all felt that we wanted something different than a military dictatorship. But we've never reached it. And the whole thing has been about trying to get more people to agree that there are problems, right? And I think alongside that, there needs to be some attempt to look at a practical strategy forward as well.
Last question, sir.
Very quickly, Frank Dell again, George Washington. I'm an ex-UN hand, actually. I just retired from UNICEF. And my on-the-ground experience in Burma was with UNICEF. Mm. Now, I listened to Ban Ki-moon last night, and he sent us a very ambitious message. I'm not sure whether you're still with the UN or not.
No, I'm not.
If, my feeling is that maybe a revamped UN might hold something for the future of Burma. If we take what Moon said seriously and we look at security, development and human rights and civic action as four pillars that need to be bolstered and strengthened by the UN, how does that ring to you as a Burmese looking at Burma as an ongoing problem?
Yeah.
Is that going to make any difference, or is that just, as we say in Spanish, pura paja, just hot air?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, I think it's absolutely right that in any situation like Burma, any sort of post-conflict situation, any armed conflict situation, any sort of crisis country, we should look at all these different issues together and as holistically as possible. I think that's true, and I'm sure it's true in Burma as well as in anywhere else. I think it's also the case that, you know, there's been a lot of focus on the Security Council as being an organ which can respond to Burma. I think it's actually very poorly suited to respond to Burma. I think the missing piece on Burma is actually much more dynamic policy under the Secretary General by the Secretariat on Burma, which hasn't really been the case so far. But even then, it's a huge uphill climb to actually get the UN to think creatively about this problem and actually act in a both a pragmatic and a creative and a principled way. I think, you know, this is only a slight exaggeration. I think Burma will be a happy and prosperous democracy long before the UN is properly reformed. So I think it's pretty fun. So maybe on that note.